Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. If you're like me, you probably know who Sigmund Freud was and that he was one of the original pioneers of psychoanalysis, but that's likely about it. Freud, much like Albert Einstein, has become a scientific caricature. But he was a real person and a serious scientist. While some of his writings and techniques have fallen in and out of favor over the decades since his most productive work in the early 20th century, our guest is someone who understands Freud better than nearly anyone. Dr. Mark Solms worked on the epic translation of the revised standard edition of the complete psychological works of Sigmund Freud, which was published in 2024. He's the director of the American Psychoanalytic Association and is one of the world's leading authorities on the brain mechanisms of dreaming. Dr. Solms has been a practicing neuroscientist and psychoanalyst for decades, and he joins us now from his home in South Africa. Mark Solms, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I'd like to find out a bit more about your early childhood. It sounds like I'm putting you through an analysis here, but tell us the story of how you got interested in neuroscience. And because it involves your family and a pretty bad event from your childhood.
Yes, I gather from what you've said that you, well, of course you know the story because you've read my book.
I have.
It has everything to do with why I ended up becoming what I did scientifically and professionally. When I was four, just going on five, my older brother, who was six going on seven, fell from the roof of a three-story building and landed on his head on the paving below, fractured his skull, and suffered a brain hemorrhage. He was flown to the nearest proper hospital because we lived in a village where they saved his life. And when he came back a few weeks later, he looked exactly the same. Apart from the fact that he had to wear a helmet to protect his fractured skull. But he was not the same. He was not the same person. And so I, at that early age, was confronted by the sort of uncanny experience of meeting this person who looked like my brother but wasn't my brother. He was a different person, different both in his personality and in his cognitive and, for that matter, physical abilities. And so I had to get my head around, as it were, the fact that the person of my brother was somehow bound up with this organ, this bodily organ that had been damaged in that fall. And it's quite something to get your head around. You know, how can it be that my brother, his name's Lee, that he's changed, that he's not the same person as the result of this injury. And I think that it must be the basis of why, I mean, I didn't decide there and then I'm going to become a brain scientist, but it must be what made me interested in not only the brain, but in particular in the relationship between brain and mind, which is what the branch of neuroscience that I specialize in is called neuropsychology, which is about exactly that, how brain and mind relate to each other. And I spent the rest of my working life I trained in that field in the early 1980s, and I spent the rest of my working life pondering exactly that relationship.
Well, there's a central character in your book, and he's very famous, Sigmund Freud. What I'd really like you to do is tell us how you became introduced to Sigmund Freud in your career and why he really is such an important and pivotal scientist in the work that you do.
Gladly. I told you why I studied in the field that I did. But in doing so, and we're speaking of the early 1980s now, I was really disappointed, in fact, dismayed by how little psyche there was in neuropsychology. The mind that we learned about was really more like an information processing device. There was no interest in why does it feel like something to be this device? Where does its sentient being come from? Where do feelings and consciousness in general come from out of these functional mechanisms? And when I asked my professors questions like that, You know, like we learned about the mechanisms of the memory systems of the brain. And I said, yes, but how do we actually experience a memory? You know, how does that come about? Basically responded by saying, don't ask questions like that. They'll be bad for your career. You know, these are not scientific questions. And I thought, gosh, I thought that's what this field is all about. How does mind arise from physiology and anatomy? But that was not what we were taught. We were not led down that path at all. So there were two things that then led me to become interested in Freud. The one was, at least for all of its faults, at least psychoanalysis studies the actual lived life of the mind, the thing that I thought the word psyche refers to in the title Psychology in Neuropsychology. So I wanted to ameliorate what was missing in my neuroscientific training. But also, as it happens, I was studying the brain mechanisms of sleep and dreaming, and I made some serendipitous findings in my early research, much to my surprise, finding that dreaming was intimately bound up with the positive motivational mechanisms of the brain. And I was dimly aware that Freud had said something about that, that Freud had said that dreams were wishful, that dreams were motivated, that dreams revealed something about, you know, what we cared about. And my early findings suggested that maybe there was some truth in those unlikely claims. So I then started to read Freud. And in fact, my first introduction to Freud was not only to his dream book, but also, because of my own field, to his neuroscientific writings. I didn't know that Freud was a neuroscientist. And the more that I immersed myself in what he'd written as a neuroscientist, the more seriously I took what he did subsequently, because it was plain to see that this was a very serious scientist. You spoke of the caricature. I had the same caricature in my mind, not only of this chap with the spectacles and the cigar and the three-piece suit and so on, but also, you know, the story that I'd been told was he wasn't a serious scientist. We don't take him seriously anymore, that he was wrong about everything. And so, you know, that was my introduction to Freud.
I was unaware that the modern view, if you will, mid-century on, like 1950s, 60s, 70s, was really, there was a movement to discount the work of Sigmund Freud. And you talk about that quite a bit. That, you know, could you discuss a bit about why the neuroscience community turned on him?
It was more the psychiatric community. I think the neuroscience community wasn't particularly interested one way or another. But the psychiatric community, in the era that you're speaking of, the 1950s and 1960s, started to make big breakthroughs in terms of psychopharmacology. So the only way in which we could treat mental illness, or not the only way, but the mainstream way of treating mental illness until then, was with talking therapy. Now there was this plethora of other methods available to us, psychiatric medications. And it's very hard to bridge that divide. It seems as if these are two antithetical ways of working. Either it's all about personal meaning, the individual development of the psyche, and so on, the sorts of things that psychoanalysts are interested in, or it's something to do with chemistry, something to do with brain physiology. So the gap between these two approaches was enormous. The interest, the novelty, the promise all lay with this new physiological approach. And so progressively, people shifted over to treating mental illness this way. Then I have to say, in parallel with that, psychoanalysts made no effort to integrate what was being learned in what was then called biological psychiatry. They made no interest to bridge this divide that I've just alluded to. And so they became sort of competing alternatives rather than two perspectives on one and the same thing, which must somehow be reconcilable with each other. They became rivals. And slowly the tide turned in favor of biological psychiatry.
Fascinating. And like, where would you say it stands today?
I think where things stand today in relation to so-called biological psychiatry is much where things stood around that time, the 1950s and 60s, with psychoanalytical psychiatry, namely that people started to lose their idealization of this approach, started to temper their expectations, started to realize, you know, this is not a silver bullet. This is not a cure-all. These sorts of things can't be dealt with. The promise of the early years, you know, slowly became jaded. So people were beginning to be disappointed in psychoanalysis in the 50s and 60s. I think they're now becoming disappointed with the psychopharmacological approach.
I do know just from some personal experience with family members that when their kids go in for therapy, they're having, you know, behavioral problems for whatever reason, drugs is kind of a go-to thing. And I have misgivings about that, with, you know, constantly treating children with drugs.
I think that a major point to make here is that what drugs do is relieve symptoms. They are directed at suppressing emotional feelings which are problematical. They're not directed at getting at the underlying causes of those feelings. So symptom relief is no small thing. But as soon as you withdraw the drugs, you're back where you started from, because it hasn't done anything about the cause. As soon as you stop suppressing the symptoms, then they come back. Now, you might think, well, why not just carry on taking the drugs forever then? And that leads to three observations. The one is, it's a bit of an overstatement to say that they suppress symptoms. They don't altogether suppress symptoms. They certainly dampen things down. But, you know, it's not as if that makes all of the troubles go away. And then they have side effects. These side effects can be quite considerable. In the case, for example, of antipsychotic medications, you have permanent irreversible side effects. Same applies to the treatments that we use for bipolar disorder. The same applies to the mainstream treatments of that time for anxiety disorders called benzodiazepines. And then thirdly, when people, because of the side effects and because of the disappointment in the symptoms not entirely going away, stop taking these drugs, they discover that there are withdrawal effects. So, you know, these are the downsides of psychopharmacology. But I would emphasize most of all that they don't cure. So it's fine to use them as for symptom relief, as long as one can do that. And I don't think one should do it for too long because of the reasons I've just said. But they don't treat the underlying condition. They don't treat the cause. Psychotherapy and psychoanalytical psychotherapy in particular aims at exactly that, at treating the cause. If I can just put it in a simple sort of way, emotions, negative emotions, are symptomatic of emotional needs not being met. So just as with hunger, you feel it when your nutritional needs are not being met. Thirst means your hydration needs are not being met, you know, etc. Likewise with emotional needs. If your need for safety or your need for attachment or your need for not having frustrating obstacles in your way, if those needs are not dealt with, then you will feel anxious or depressed, or you'll have anger management problems. So what psychotherapy aims at, and especially psychoanalytical psychotherapy, is helping our patients to find better ways of meeting their emotional needs. So that's the cause. What's causing the symptoms is you're not doing what's needed in order to satisfy that need. And we aim to help our patients to find better ways of meeting those needs. To the extent that we succeed in that, we have cured the problem. And so you stop the treatment, the symptoms then come back because the new way of meeting the needs remains in place. That's it in a nutshell.
Yes, and your book does a beautiful job of kind of laying that all out. You use a case study of a guy named Teddy, who was one of your patients, who has some, you know, extremely complex problems. And as I recall, when he came to you, he was using drugs for therapy. And you kind of introduce us to him at the beginning of the book. And I don't want to give things away because that's what's kind of fun about reading the book. But you go through the whole book as kind of a way for you to understand, okay, here's what's going on with the mind, so that when I get to this conclusion and tell you what happened with my patient Teddy, you'll understand. And I thought that was a beautiful way of laying this out.
Thank you. I'm glad that you mentioned that patient, because it makes me realize there was something that I should have mentioned in response to your previous question, which is drug interaction effects, what's called polypharmacy. Unfortunately, the way psychiatry works these days is if the patient's anxious, you give them an anxiolytic. If the patient's depressed as well, you give them an antidepressant too. If they then have sleep problems, you give them a sleeping pill, you know, and so on. And the accumulation of all of these different drugs, you end up treating with one drug the side effects of the other drug. And then you end up in the kind of sorry state that patient Teddy was in when he first came to me. Sadly, Teddy, the problems that he had are not entirely unusual for exactly the reason that I've just described. The way you just set it out is exactly what I tried to do. I set up, you know, here's this case. These are his symptoms. This is what I thought was problematical about the way he was being treated. I took him off most of his medications. And then let me explain how it comes about that people have symptoms like this. And then that's the body of the book, explaining, you know, where mental suffering comes from as best we understand it from a 21st century point of view, and trying in the process to translate Freud's old language and Freud's psychological way of understanding things into modern terms and evaluating his understanding from the viewpoint of modern science. And then we return to the case of Teddy. And I say, given all of what I've shown you in these pages, now let me explain why I was able to help Teddy in the way that I did, and why I went about it in the way that I did. And then we complete the case study.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with psychoanalyst and neuropsychologist Mark Solms as we talk about his new book, The Only Cure, Freud and the Neuroscience of Mental Healing. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Hey there, gentle listener, Dave Shlohm here, and I want to thank you for listening to the podcast version of Blue Dot. We'll get right back to our interview with neuroscientist Mark Solms as we talk about the relevance of the work of Sigmund Freud today. But first, I want to remind you that without the support of our listeners, this show would not be possible. So if you enjoy the content we provide, I hope you'll take a moment and make a donation to the NPR member station that produces it, North State Public Radio. You can make a donation at our website, mynspr.org. And now, let's get back to the show. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our look at the world of psychoanalysis and neuroscience with Dr. Mark Solms. He's the author of the new book, The Only Cure, Freud and the Science of Mental Healing. Let's talk about dreams, because I think they're an interesting way to get into this story arc with Freud and your work. He wrote a famous book about dreams. I'd like you to tell us, what was his point of view on dreams? And then I'd like to talk about how things kind of turned around against that and then came full circle through your work. So start out by telling us, what did Freud think about dreams?
Sure. You have to remember, first of all, that in Freud's day, there were no methods for studying the living brain. The only way you could study what's going on in the brain while it's going on those days was from the point of view of self-report, of the person saying what they're thinking and feeling, with why they think they're doing what they're doing, and so on. The only method that was available then was autopsy. So that's not a living brain, that's a dead brain. Now we have a plethora of methods for studying the living brain, but at that time, talking was the only thing we could do, self-report. So Freud availed himself of that method. He got his patients to say, when they told him dreams, which he was interested in because they seem, they very much do seem like mental illness. You know, you're hallucinating, you're deluded. This is a crazy state of mind. So Freud thought, well, maybe if I understand something about dreams, I'll understand something about psychopathology. So he was particularly interested in dreams and asked his patients, after they reported their dreams to him, to say everything that came into their heads in connection with the dream. So he was trying to gather as much evidence as possible to be able to discern, why is this person dreaming that? What does that particular memory mean to them? How does it fit into the fabric of their lives? What is this thought? How does it connect to that thought, you know, in the dream? So he's trying to work out from this nonsensical, fragmented experience dream. He was trying to discern what are the underlying connections, what is what he called the latent structure. What can you infer about what the mechanisms are that are producing this imagery? And that led him to the, I have to say, very unlikely conclusion that in fact, every dream is an attempt to fulfill a heartfelt wish, something that's being frustrated, some raw nerve that's being touched upon during the waking day. At night, your mind is trying to resolve those difficulties by turning it all around into a happy ending, and so that the frustrated need is satisfied, the raw nerve that's been touched, you know, is ameliorated, and so on. That was Freud's conclusion, that behind every dream, there's a structured mental process, which is an attempt to fulfill a wish. Now, the crucial thing is the person doesn't dream of a wish being fulfilled. The analyst infers that behind the dream is this very heartfelt wish or need or desire. Karl Popper, the famous philosopher of science, said, well, if the patient doesn't actually consciously dream the wish, and the analyst has to infer it, then you can never disprove this theory. Because no matter what the person dreams, the analyst can always say, ah, behind that, I infer a wish. And even if the patient says, well, I don't think that's a wish of mine, they'll say, oh, well, you know, that's because you're resisting acknowledging it, and so on. And these are the famous saws, you know, about psychoanalysis. But it's very important that on this basis, Karl Popper said, this is not science. And you asked me earlier about the tide turning against Freud. That coincided also with Karl Popper's famous book, Conjectures and Refutations, from the 1950s. And so in philosophy of science, too, Freud took a big knock there.
Because it wasn't falsifiable.
That's the word that Popper used.
Yes.
This theory is not falsifiable, therefore it's not science. Then the biological approach that we were talking about earlier started to take root. And so we then used the first method that we had for observing the living brain. This was the EEG, the electroencephalograph. It's a rough and ready tool, but at least, you know, you can study something about what's going on underneath the skull in a living human being. And so we were studying how does the brain activity measure differently from sleep and wakefulness. And then within sleep, we discovered, to our surprise, I say we, meaning neuroscientists, discovered in the 50s that the brain, not only does it, the brain waves become much slower as you go into sleep, which is not surprising, but every 90 minutes, they become fast again and start to look very much like the conscious brain. And that led to the hypothesis that perhaps during this paradoxical reactivation of the brain during sleep, we are seeing the physiological equivalent of the paradoxical reemergence of consciousness in the form of dreams while we're asleep. And that hypothesis was tested by waking people up during this, what came to be known as rapid eye movement sleep, this paradoxical re-aroused brain. And the hypothesis was confirmed. If you wake people up during that phase of sleep, 90% of the time, they'll report a dream. If you wake them up in the intermediate phases, the what we call slow wave or non-REM sleep, then you get dream reports about 10% of the time. That led to the possibility of identifying the brain mechanisms of dreaming, because we had found this biological, physiological, objective correlate of the mental state. So we could dispense with these subjective reports and all of the troubles that come with that. And we can look at the objective physical facts about the brain when it's dreaming. And that led to the discovery that, well, not only what I've already mentioned, dreams turn on every 90 minutes. So this is kind of like by clockwork. But the part of the brain that generates REM sleep is got nothing to do with motivation. It's in a very lowly part of the brain. It's just an arousal mechanism. It just activates the cortex in this kind of random way. And so the view took hold by the 1970s that dreaming is just random activation of the cortex by this primitive reflex brainstem mechanism that works like a clock.
One of the conclusions that you reached, you know, when I was listening to one of your talks that I thought was very interesting and insightful as we talk about this period of, you know, the discovery of REM sleep and its connection to dreams, is you make a very important point that REM sleep is not dreaming. It happens during that, but dreaming and REM are two distinct things. And I think that's important to understand.
Yes. Why that problem arose is the correlation between dreaming and REM sleep was made in human beings. But in order to identify the brain mechanisms involved, one has to do very invasive experiments. And so these were done on non-human animals who, of course, can't report their dreams. So the psychological side was abandoned, and we looked only at the anatomy and physiology. And so in identifying the brain mechanisms of REM sleep, we assumed we were identifying the brain mechanisms of dreaming because of the high correlation. But you have a scientific background. You know that correlation is not causation, let alone identity. And so what I did in the 80s and 90s was studied a very large number of human beings. Obviously, I didn't damage their brains as we do in rats and cats when we discovered the REM mechanisms. I waited for a sufficiently large number of patients to be accumulated in my study where I could, because they were human beings, I could look at what the effects were on dreaming of these damage to these different parts of the brain. And I found it absolutely to my surprise. First of all, patients who have damage to the part of the brain that generates REM sleep, that part of the brainstem, they lose REM sleep, but they continue to dream. So this was a really something you can't learn with rats and cats. So it was a real shock to discover in every human patient with damage there who loses REM sleep continues to dream. Conversely, there's another part of the brain which I mentioned earlier, this major motivational circuit, when that's damaged, dreaming stops, but REM sleep continues. So that made the point that you just made, namely these two things, they're not the same thing. Dreaming can happen without REM sleep, and REM sleep can happen without dreaming, and the two different mechanisms are connected to two different parts of the brain. So that was, to close the circle, to what I said to you earlier, that was what made me realize, hang on, Freud might have had a point here. And importantly, I want to add that it also answers Popper's problem. Popper says this theory is not testable. Well, that may be so, using the method of just listening to and talking to people about their dreams. But if you study their brains and you discover that any neuroscientist, if you were to say, which part of the brain would be the equivalent of, you know, this force that Freud says, this wishful drive that Freud says lies behind dreams, they would say, well, it's the brain reward center, this dopaminergic circuit, which is exactly the circuit that drives the dream process as opposed to the REM process. So that's the story.
Yes, and it's just so fascinating how it comes full circle back to Freud was correct, essentially. And one of the things I loved your conclusion from your studies, like, why do we dream? And you make a very simple statement after that dreams protect sleep. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes, that's another one of Freud's unlikely claims, which again, using purely psychological methods, you know, you can't test it. Using neurological methods, you can. Now that I had a group of patients who do not dream because the part of the brain that is necessary for generating dreams is damaged, it was possible to say, okay, well, if Freud was right that dreams protect sleep, then these patients who can't dream should have bad sleep. And there again, it proves the point that you can falsify Freudian theory if you use the methods that are available to us now that weren't available in Freud's time. It's also a counterintuitive hypothesis. Most lay people would think, well, if you can't dream, you'll sleep better. But on Freud's theory, if you can't dream, you'll sleep worse because dreams protect sleep. So I was really pleased to be able to do that study because I thought whatever I find, at least it demonstrates this theory is falsifiable. And to add to that, the fact that the finding was so very strongly in favor of the hypothesis that patients who can't dream have terrible, terrible sleep, and patients who do dream have much better sleep. So the hypothesis is confirmed. That means in Popperian terms, it's provisionally held to be true.
Let's talk a bit more in detail about what's called the talking cure. And, you know, I had a picture in my head of, you know, when a psychiatrist back, you know, watching movies back in the 50s and 60s, you know, the patient comes in, lays on the couch, faces the other way. The doctor sits there and they go through that free association thing. And can you explain to us, you know, kind of the structure of how it actually works?
Yes. First of all, the original way in which psychoanalysis was practiced, it was multiple sessions a week, lying on a couch with the analyst behind you. And this was a remnant of hypnotism. You know, Freud first learnt in the 1890s from Charcot and others that the patient lies down and you put them into a hypnotic trance, and this is how you try to get what lies behind their conscious thoughts and so on. And he gradually found that he was able to get what lies behind conscious thoughts without having to go to these lengths. And he also found that he wasn't a very good hypnotist. He couldn't induce trances in people that easily, and many people just don't go into a hypnotic trance. And so this other method that he used was to just get them to say everything that comes into their heads. As I said about dreams, this Freud did quite generally. He said, just tell me everything that comes into your mind in connection with, you know, everything else. In other words, don't try and think your way through this. Just present me with the raw material of everything that's on your mind, and I will try to discern what the underlying connections are, join the dots, and see what the latent organizing structure of your mind is, and then I will impart that to you. And in this way, you will know yourself. You will become more the owner of your own mental house. Things won't just happen to you. You will have greater choice, a greater ownership, as it were, of your own volition. So that was the idea. And in its essence, that's still what we're trying to do. But we're trying to do it in the most efficient way possible. So it's not necessary to lie down on a couch, first of all. Many people find it easier to say what's on their minds when they're not looking at somebody and having to, you know, sort of face the music, as it were. But some people find it strange, you know, to talk to some disembodied person behind you. So it's not an essential part of the technique. We've also found it, you know, although it's true that the more sessions you have, of course, the better. I mean, this applies quite sort of obviously, that it's not necessary to have all these sessions. So we've got shorter term psychotherapies and we've got less frequent sessions. And all of this we measure empirically. So we are trying to, on an empirical scientific basis, get to the crux of what is the therapeutic mechanism that's at work in this cure, and how can we deliver it in the most scalable way, in the most efficient way possible. And all of this, unlike in the 50s and 60s when psychoanalysts were on their high horse saying, you know, we don't need to measure what we're doing, we know it works and so on. Eventually, they got with that program and realized that, you know, in this era of evidence-based medicine, you've got to measure these things. And so we now have a lot of data from randomized controlled trials measuring objectively what is effective about this treatment. And in this way, we can say with confidence, you don't have to have all these years and you don't have to have that many sessions. You can get the essential benefits from this talking therapy in much more affordable and less time consuming and less effortful ways. But I have to say, having said that, unfortunately, it still requires much more time and effort than taking a pill. And so the seduction of the fallacy that you can change your life just by taking a pill, the seduction is very strong, and many people still, you know, would rather take that approach. There is much more hard work involved in really grappling with what it is that's gone wrong in your life and trying to change it.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with South African psychoanalyst and neuropsychologist Mark Solms, as we talk about his new book, The Only Cure, Freud and the Neuroscience of Mental Healing. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Dave Shlohm here, and we'll get right back to our interview with South African psychoanalyst and neuropsychologist Mark Solms. But before we do, I wanted to take a moment to thank you for listening to and supporting this program. If you've never perused our archives, it's well worth a look at the myriad of topics we've covered in recent years. You can do that at mynsbr.org. And while you're at it, consider making a donation to the public radio station that produces Blue Dot, North State Public Radio. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. We're speaking with South African neuroscientist Mark Solms about his new book, The Only Cure, Freud and the Neuroscience of Mental Healing.
A central part of one's training as a psychoanalyst is that one has to be psychoanalyzed oneself. And the rationale for that is there are several reasons, but probably the pivotal one is that the instrument that we use, if I can use the analogy of an instrument, the instrument that we use to deliver our treatment is our own minds. You sitting there listening to a patient, and you're using what I suppose could just simply be called empathy. In other words, feeling your way into what is it that's making them tick? What's going on here? It resonates with your own knowledge and your own feelings and your own life experiences. And so there needs to be some check on how well calibrated this instrument is. So this is the main reason why you have to have psychoanalysis yourself, so that you don't project your own problems or get your own buttons pressed and so on in ways that make you unable to see objectively as possible and be open as possible to what's actually going on. There's also the less crucial fact that it's a bit draining, you know, it's a bit harrowing. The kinds of things that people bring to us are overwhelming. That's why they're coming to us. It's because they can't cope. They aren't coping. The terrible things have happened to them. They're having terrible experiences in the present stage of their life. That many of them feel, I just don't want to carry on anymore. You know, there's suicidal risks and so on. So you need to be steeled as much as possible to being able to deal with all of these sorts of things. So that's also why your own treatment is an important sort of prophylactic and an important support. It's not only that, it's also we especially in the early years of practice, and when I say early years, I mean, you know, for a good many years after you've qualified, you have supervision. So that there's somebody, you know, who can help you looking over your shoulder at what you're doing and what you're feeling and how you're dealing with it. So these are, you know, some of the things that you're touching on there. I want to add one other remark, which is that we are entirely at the disposal of the patient. We are there to understand and to convey understanding. We're not there to judge. We're not there to react. We're not there to look after our own interests. So it's a sort of remarkably altruistic and sort of selfless state of mind that's required of the analyst. And what I say to my students is the only reason we can do this, apart from the facts that I've just told you, in other words, that we've had our own analysis and all of that, is we don't have to live with our patients. We have them for 1 hour at a time. And during that 1 hour, you know, you can forego all of your own needs and your and the buttons that the patient presses and so on. You just have to, you know, sit on your hands and put aside your own feelings and your own judgments and be entirely at the disposal of what's in the best interests of your patient. I think that would be impossible to do if you actually lived with them as their friends and loved ones and colleagues and so on have to do. So they get into all kinds of trouble in their real lived life, and then they can come to you and have the luxury of not getting into that trouble with you, that all that you're doing is trying to understand what is it that's going on here that leads them normally to get into that trouble.
What is the mechanism or process that happens through the talking therapy, what you do, that in the end, hopefully, you know, causes change? What is it that happens that it makes this just such an effective technique? Because, you know, by all accounts and looking at the statistics, it is very effective.
Yes. So I'll build on what I said previously about helping our patients to find better ways of meeting their emotional needs. The ways in which we go about meeting our emotional needs, for the most part, the foundations of that are laid in childhood. And incidentally, that's another literally discovery of Freud's. We nowadays all take it for granted that early childhood experience sort of casts the die for the adult personality. And there's oodles of very good evidence that this is the case. But the point is that it is like that. And in the earliest years, there's this thing called infantile amnesia, as Freud called it. We now understand from a neuroscientific point of view how it works. But the fact is, as any of our listeners will attest, we don't really remember our earliest childhood. The first few years are shrouded in amnesia. And so the ways in which we learned how to meet our emotional needs when we were little, which then become the sort of scaffolding for everything that we learn later, we are not aware of what those strategies are. Our solutions to life's problems that we formulated in childhood are not transparent to us. And there's all sorts of complicated stories there as to how this happens, which we understand again and now from a neuroscientific point of view. But this is what Freud called the unconscious, that they, what we now call the non-declarative memory systems, that these things we learned in childhood, how to go about dealing with life's problems, we are implementing those policies without any awareness that we even have policies, let alone that we're implementing them. So what we do in psychoanalysis is to try to discern those patterns, the patterns of how the patient is going about meeting their emotional needs and dealing with the conflicts between them, because they keep repeating those patterns. And that we call transference. They're transferring their childhood solutions into the present day. And although they can't remember what those childhood solutions were, we can point out in the present, you know, can you see you doing this? Can you see you doing this over and again? And can you see that when you do this is when that emotional situation arises? And so this is how you're going about dealing with that. So in this way, we make the patient aware of how they are meeting their needs, so that they have an opportunity to judge with their adult minds, now under no duress, in the presence of a professional who's helping them to understand and think through these things, how else they might have gone about dealing with those situations. And so they can come up with new ways of meeting their needs. And when we do that, this is called transference interpretation. Can you see you doing this over and again? Can you see it's meant to meet that need? Can you see it isn't actually working and that's why you're suffering that feeling? You know, this is a big moment for the patient. They, for the first time, feel they really understand where their suffering comes from, and what's more, that it's in their hands, their own hands. But nevertheless, they still do it again. And that's because it is, hello, unconscious. It's automatic. And so you say to the patient, you did it again, you did it again. This is called working through. And eventually the patient says it themselves. Oh my gosh, I did it again. Oh my God, there I go again. And then ultimately comes the point where the patient recognizes, I am doing it again. While they're doing it, they catch themselves in the grip of, oh, yeah, this is this pattern that I've learned about in my therapy. Here I am about to do it again, and then they can choose not to. You know, the famous free will, at this point, they have free won't, the freedom to choose rather than to do something compulsively and automatically. And then they don't need you anymore. Once the patient is seeing, oh, here I'm going again, and chooses, that's what we're aiming for, choice, for more freedom to decide how you want to live your life rather than, you know, these forces just acting through you. At that point, they don't need you anymore. But then that working through mechanism that I've just referred to, that carries on after the treatment. And so you were saying that we have the numbers show that this is a very effective treatment. What I think is the single most important part of those numbers that we've accumulated in measuring the effectiveness of this treatment is that the curative effect continues after the end of the treatment, by which I mean the symptom relief, not only is it maintained, it actually improves. The patient gets more better. And that's because this working through process carries on, not in the presence of an analyst, but the patient, you know, recognizing themselves, their own patterns, and choosing to act otherwise.
Yes, which brings us back to your point about using pharmaceuticals, is you don't have to use, you get to stop that. You know, you don't need anything more. You've got what you need for now. You're not needing to just continue taking pills.
Yes, that's right. So we measure the treatment effects with a thing called effect sizes. And 0.2 is a slightly effective treatment. 0.4 is a moderately effective treatment. 0.8 is a highly effective treatment. On average, anti-anxiety drugs, antidepressants, they have a 0.4. In other words, they're moderately effective. People, the best kept secret in psychiatry is that psychoanalysis has a 0.8 effect size. In other words, it's a highly effective treatment. And then, as you were just mentioning, when you stop the drugs, you go from 0.4 back to 0.0, you know, because the treatment is gone and you haven't changed the cause. Whereas in psychoanalysis, you go from 0.8 to 1 to 1.2, like off the charts effectiveness. And so the drug companies have big marketing budgets. Psychoanalysis doesn't have a marketing department. So I think in a way, perhaps that's also what I'm trying to do with this book, to tell the public, you know, what the facts are. So my book is the marketing department for psychoanalysis.
You know, it's funny. It reminds me of, there's a commercial that's been running on the radio lately, and it's actually the flip side of this, where they're talking about, you know, healthcare, and they say, you know, we recommend dinner with mom, you know, unconditional love, and you get, you know, but be prepared for a 4-hour conversation. If it goes on longer, then consult your doctor. And it's kind of a joke about, like, instead of taking drugs, why don't you go have dinner with your mom, or go walk and talk with a friend? And I just thought that was, you know, kind of, you reminded me of that with, yeah, you see all these pharmaceutical commercials on TV all the time. But I love those commercials, because it is true. It's like, you know, there's nothing better than actually just talking to a good old friend human being, rather than resulting to constantly having to take something. Okay, you know, Freud and Einstein were contemporaries, and it's, you know, it's interesting thinking about them being around at the same time. And in my lifetime, there's been, you know, one really big question going on, especially within the space science community, and that is there life beyond Earth? That's one of the big questions in science, and one of the big questions for all time. Are we alone in the universe? Is it just us? Or is there life elsewhere? That's, you know, a driver for much of NASA's missions to Mars and things like that. And then it seems to me the other huge question is, what is the nature of consciousness? What is it that makes me, me, and my experiential self? You know, what is that? Because that's a mysterious thing. Are we anywhere near being able to really understand what that is?
What you're talking about is what philosophers call the hard problem of consciousness. And neuroscience is grappling with this problem. It's probably the the cutting edge question in modern neuroscience. I believe we are making progress, and I have to be brief, as you say, so I'll just cut to the chase. I think that in order to address this problem, we need to reduce it to its simplest form. Consciousness, human consciousness, is an extremely complicated thing. We shouldn't start with the most complicated form of cognition known to nature. We should start with its most elementary form, which is just raw feeling. That's the most basic form, the most ancient form of consciousness. And I think that that's the most promising way forward. The chances of us being able to understand scientifically how a simple feeling, like a feeling of pain or a feeling of hunger, arises biologically, physically, mechanistically, I think our chances of solving that are pretty reasonable. And then we can generalize from there upwards to the more complex forms of consciousness. That's my take.
Yeah. Well, it's like I'm looking at a photograph on my wall. It's a beautiful picture of the Sierra Nevada mountains, and it's got these gorgeous clouds and colors. And I look at it and it gives me pleasure. It makes me feel good. I like to look at it. And I wonder why is that? Why is it that I love looking at that? You know, what is it about that that I respond to? You know, what creates that? It's just such a fascinating thing to think about. So I want to thank you so much for joining us and talking about these really deep subjects.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed our conversation, and I'll end with an observation about what you said there, which is, I think we mustn't underestimate the place of feeling in our lives. The pleasure that you referred to there, this is what it's all about, is we're trying to feel better and avoid things that make us feel worse. And that's what my field is all about.
Well, Dr. Mark Solms, author of The Only Cure, Freud and the Neuroscience of Mental Healing, it's been wonderful to talk to you, and I want to thank you.
Thanks so much, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to our guest, psychoanalyst and neuropsychologist, Dr. Mark Solms. You can find his new book, published by Pegasus, The Only Cure, Freud and the Neuroscience of Mental Healing, at most major booksellers or order it at your favorite local bookstore. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises and licensed to California State University Chico in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynsbr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.